This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
We just gotta be committed to the ideal and fight for it, understanding that people are gonna be unsettled by it.
We will always have to fight for diversity, always have to fight for inclusion, because democracy is just not a given.
This is Created Equal from 101.9 WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, the host, and I'm here with Carrie Jr. II.
Hello.
Who is the show's producer. Carrie.
Yes.
What a week we had on Created Equal, our third week of shows. And in this week, we continue to stretch the umbrella of the idea of inequality and opportunity to talk about things that maybe listeners haven't thought of as part of that conversation and do it in a really innovative way.
I think this week we put on, or we invented, for lack of a better word, a time machine for us to travel back in time, right? We talked about a lot of historical elements, some to retell and reinform and some to get new information.
Yeah. I mean, we had this really great conversation with Princeton African-American Studies professor Eddie Glaude, who's one of my favorite thinkers right now in the country. I mean, somebody who's really leaning in hard on these questions about racial reconciliation, but putting them in a bigger context. We had a conversation with him about the things that Nikki Haley, who will be on the ballot here next week with Donald Trump during the Republican nominating process, we had this conversation about her comments about the Civil War and how she was not sure in the answer to a question that the Civil War was about slavery. Right. Eddie had a really interesting take on all of that and what it means.
Yeah, definitely. And I think on its face, that comment by Nikki Haley, you're thinking, like, this is ridiculous. Like, of course, the Civil War was about slavery. But part of why you wanted to do this episode, why we wanted to do this episode, was there are people who are misinformed and don't know the history or why that history is important. I think oftentimes there's the rhetoric of, you know, history will repeat itself if you don't study
it. You don't learn from it.
But in this conversation, not only did we talk about the history itself, but you also talked about the feelings that white Americans can often feel that prevents them from accepting and acknowledging that history, which I think is a different a take or a approach from that than just this is what happened with the Civil War, which— It is documented. You can go and read it, but
you can
great
go
conversation.
Read about it, right? Right. But we had this great conversation about why it matters and how it informs the things that we're talking about today. We also had a conversation about immigration, which is something that we see every night now, I think, on the news. And if you're on social, there's this raging debate about who should be allowed to come here to be an American. And here again, we took the time machine back, this time all the way to the beginning of the country, to the conversations that the founders had as they were putting the Constitution together about this very question: who should be allowed to immigrate into this nation?
And I think, you know, when y'all had this conversation for the book club, one was in the theme of the Constitution, and of course you've already mentioned how the context of immigration colors and informs that discussion, but it's still relevant today. I mean, I can speak for myself where it's frustrating to not feel like our politics are coming to conclusions that are beneficial for our country as a whole, specifically a country that was founded by people who immigrated here, right?
Yes.
And
everybody here.
Everybody.
Came here.
Outside of Native Americans, of course.
Yes.
And it informs what's going on today and why it is that we haven't been able to get anything move forward. And it was a good conversation, good information. I really hope that there's something that can be done moving forward policy-wise, though.
Yeah, no, Congress is tripped up on this. They have been for about 15 years now. No major immigration legislation has been able to pass. And then we also had a conversation this week with Andre Perry, who is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, about some research that he's done, again, back in the past, this time about the period of time between 1870 and 1940, this period of incredible invention and innovation in American history, and the roles that African Americans played in that period, but that they often don't get any acknowledgement for, that it's either forgotten or dismissed, Perry lifts it up and shows how profoundly African Americans actually participated in all of that.
Yeah, I'm going to steal the statistic or the finding that you often point to in his research, that Black Americans in the North were issued more patents than white Americans in the South, which highlights how the racism in this country, depending on the region you are in, affects not only Black Americans, but also white Americans too. And what that means. So it was an interesting finding for sure.
Yeah, it creates stagnation, intellectual stagnation, process stagnation, all the kinds of things that are things that dynamics that will defeat innovation in a society. And what he draws out in that report is how dramatically that happened to the American South in that era, which is after the Civil War, but during Jim Crow and the era of lynching and all of the real difficulties that they had. So that is a really fascinating conversation and research. And that's where we start our Friday roundup with this excerpt of the conversation with Andre Perry from the Brookings Institution. Andre, I want to start here talking about the importance of going back now to unearth all of these truths about this era. You know, we live in a very strange era right now, I think, where there is an active debate going on about whether we should talk about the past and how we should talk about the past. Nikki Haley, a former South Carolina governor who's running for president, says out loud that we really ought not talk about things like slavery when we talk about race in the United States today, that those are things of the past. And, you know, ironically, she was governor of South Carolina, the state that started the Civil War. She also says, well, it wasn't really all about slavery. And there are a lot of people who feel that way. Your work stares that in the face and pushes back in another direction. I want to give you some time to talk about why you do that and why it's important for us as a country to be able to have those conversations and to do those things.
Well, for such a long time, America has pretended to be the home of the free and land of the brave and a lot of noble attributes assigned to it. And certainly every country tries to put a good face on itself. But the reality is that when you do that, when you mask the history, you are masking the people who contributed to its greatness. There are certainly the stain of slavery cannot be ignored, nor should it. We're making history when we deny it. Ambassador Haley made her comments, she was just adding to the negative history instead of really elevating this moment as an opportunity to share how we are advancing or not as a country. When you are living in a country, in our context, people understand in real terms, you know, what is happening in their lives. You can't say, hey, look, the world is great and unemployment and police shootings and all these things are happening around it. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. And so for me, I work in a fact-based organization. We show and reveal facts that hopefully will advance policy so that we can be the democracy that we pretend to be. And so for me, it is imperative to correct the record where it needs to be corrected. It is imperative for us to show facts so that people can make informed decisions. When you are making decisions off of false narratives, people are bound to be hurt.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm glad you brought up Nikki Haley, Ambassador Haley, mm-hmm. because we also see that history is very political. It is attached to power. People use history to their advantage to make claims to resources. So if you can say, hey, that white people invented everything, then we should invest in white people. That's, you know, that's the implicit statement. Yeah. The reality is that black people, brown people, women are involved in change. And when they are not involved in change, it's because we are suppressing that change. People are people. You know, race is a social construct.
Yeah.
And when we don't see people rising to the highest levels of science, math, engineering, in the arts and other things, that means there's suppression going on. So for me, one of the reasons why we wrote this report is to show that when given opportunities, people create, people invent, people thrive. When they are suppressed, not only don't we see that innovation, you see a low quality of life overall.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the things that also kind of jumps out at me about the research here is the influence of so back to this difference between the North and the South, both in terms of black invention and white invention. The difference in conditions in the North, and as you pointed out, nothing was perfect. I mean, there was still discrimination, but it wasn't like it was in the South. But it also leads to other kinds of innovation and development. I mean, I'm thinking of many of the cultural innovations and changes that happen in this stretch of time from the 1870s to the 1940s as well. The Harlem Renaissance, the invention of jazz, all of these things that profoundly change our lives are things that find their roots in this era, and they find their roots more in the North, where these innovations were easier to come by for blacks and whites than they did in the oppressive South.
Yeah, you know, when we talk about innovation, we kind of limit it to
technology, right?
But let's be clear that many of the social organizations and policy organizations that we're familiar with today emerged during this period as well. The Brookings Institution emerged in this period, mm-hmm. Around 1920, I believe, not that far away, when the NAACP was emerged. And also the civil rights movement, the early civil rights movement occurred during this period. So there were so many innovations. Art, you mentioned the Harlem Renaissance. Mm-hmm. There so many places people were reinventing what blackness was. We were reinventing what a civil society looked like. Because one of the things I always say, there's nothing more innovative than care, that we're constantly learning how to care for one another. And that was evolving, but certainly as we moved out of slavery, out of Reconstruction, Jim Crow racism, we were still learning how to care for one another. And we're still trying to innovate in that way.
Yeah, yeah.
So for me, let's not ignore the social and artistic contributions of African Americans during the period, because without those that social movement, you wouldn't get a George Washington Carver, we know, for his peanut production, mm-hmm. and Madam C.J. Walker, who worked on hair products. They were also part of a social movement that included innovation as well. So let's keep that in mind.
Yeah. There is also government innovation and change during this time that changes life in the country. Of course, the 1870s is right after the Civil War and the passage of the Civil War amendments to the Constitution, and government is pushed to respond, I think, to some of the innovation that follows this second founding, really, of the United States, that is about more equality, even if it's not absolute equality. And so some of that social change you're talking about is both reflected in and driven by the change in the way that government sees its role.
Yeah, I mean, remember the start of the Constitution, black people are 3/5 of a person.
Right, and slavery is legal.
Slavery legal. We had to create amendments for people to be recognized as full human beings and citizens, and that had the rights and privileges that were ascribed to white people. And let's not, we always forget women. Women were not afforded basic rights as well. And so government was really changed. It was built around white men. And luckily, gladly, fortunately, I don't know how we should say this, but there was enough room and language imbued in the Constitution where it could evolve to include others. But it did wrap itself around the lived experiences of wealthy white landowners.
Mm-hmm.
And many of the early laws and policies reflected that. But because of an opening of democracy, an opening of freedom, it was inevitable, in my opinion, that slavery would fall, that Jim Crow racism would fall. Mm. But it's also inevitable that people will want our laws and policies to wrap around a particular population, because that's the way power works.
Yeah.
People want to hoard and control resources. And so we will always have to fight for diversity, always have to fight for inclusion, because democracy is just not a given
in any
day or context.
Yeah, it requires constant vigilance. If we learn nothing since the founding of this country, it's that. That was Andre Perry at the Brookings Institution, who has a recent report about American innovation and the role of Black Americans in American innovation. Coming up, we're going to talk with Princeton professor Eddie Gloud about the history of the Civil War and why it's so important to get that history right. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. Welcome back to Created Equal. We also talked this week with Princeton African American Studies professor Eddie Gloud about this assertion that presidential candidate Nikki Haley has made that somehow the Civil War was about something other than slavery at its core. Gloud is someone who thinks an awful lot about this moment of racial reckoning and talk with us about the importance of getting history right in order to make that reckoning possible. Eddie, I want to start this part of the conversation in modern times as opposed to in history. And I want to read from a 2007 Supreme Court decision in a case that was about the use of race in assigning children to schools in Seattle. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote in that case that the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. Justice Sonia Sotomayor, who opposed the court's decision in that case, said, "The way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to speak openly and candidly on the subject of race and to apply the Constitution with eyes open to the unfortunate effects of centuries of racial discrimination." I think that those two opposing quotes really crystallize how what we are just talking about the Civil War and its causes, still kind of plays out today in the ways in which we try to address inequality on the basis of race. That you do have one side that's saying, listen, policies that are race conscious are analogous to racial discrimination. Another side saying, well, you can't fix the problem if you're not conscious of the problem. It is such a crystal clear difference. And I think it really summarizes the challenge that we have.
Absolutely. And it goes all the way back to the antebellum period. I mean, you could see these arguments in the Colored American in the 1800s, right? I mean, it's William Whipper and the like, right? Talking about racial designation. I mean, how does one talk about, you know, disparate policing based upon race without the category of race?
Right.
How does one talk about, you know, wealth disparities in the housing, or how do we talk about discrimination in the housing market without race language? How do we, you know, so in other words, we need the language to be able to describe the way certain groups are being singled out for differential treatment. And so in some ways, it's a bad faith gesture or a bad faith argument in the sense, right? So if we cannot use race language to describe discriminatory acts for fear that in doing so, we reinscribe racist thinking, right? That allows for that discrimination to exist unremarked, unnoted. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it's one of the ways in which, you know, conservatives have, you know, distorted and twisted the notion of colorblindness for their own ends in order to maintain, you know, historical inequality. I mean, how can I put it? Racial inequality, Doc, is not an accident in the country. It is a result of deliberate policy.
Right.
And if we're going to undo it, we have to be as deliberate in trying to undo it as we were in creating it.
So let me play devil's advocate here just for a second. Is there something to the idea at all that we have become too obsessive about talking about race, and that it leans into the idea of it as a problem instead of as an opportunity to do something different? I mean, what Justice Roberts says there is, I don't know, there's something really, really plain and appealing about it, right? It's plain talk, right? Stop discriminating on race. Just stop talking about race. Talk about why if he's wrong, why we can solve this by leaning into our problems rather than thinking about our opportunities.
Well, you know, I think it's both and, you know? I think we have to figure out ways to not fall into the trap of reducing human beings to race or to color. But we also have to be very, very clear and mindful of the ways in which race, right, organizes our social and economic and political lives. I mean, in those schools, I mean, when we think about how deeply segregated, right, American public education is, and how deeply rooted that segregation happens to be in terms of, are tied to residential segregation, and the history of residential segregation in the country, there's no way we're going to get to the place where race is like, you know, no different than the clothes I have on my back, right?
Right.
If we don't understand how it's impacting the distribution of benefit and burden, right? I mean, this is the thing. We live in a society where some people are valued more because of the color of their skin, and that valuation impacts the distribution of advantage and disadvantage. It has so, and it has done so for generations. And we just can't blink and say that's not true.
Right.
And then move into some other way of being in the world. I think aspirationally, right? I would love to live in a society where the color of my skin isn't determinative of opportunity or burden, right? I would love to just simply be, to live fully in the culture that makes me who I am.
Right.
Without it coming with all of the stuff that it comes with in terms of a racist or white supremacist society. But we can't get there.
But you know that's not true. You don't live in that society.
Exactly. It's like Marx, you know, Marx is, you know, those who read their Marx know that, you know, he's not just going to jump to this classless, this utopian vision of a classless society. We have to go through it. So we got to figure out how to get out of history's ass pocket, as Baldwin would say. Right. You just can't just jump out of it.
Yeah. So I also wonder if it's worth. So sometimes I struggle with the idea that colorblindness is even the goal, right? And not in the utopian sense, right? Of course, we would love to have a world where color didn't mean the things that it does. But in a practical sense, I guess, the idea that you would be able to create a system of government or a structure of law that was colorblind just doesn't seem possible. And so, you know, I guess I wonder if the push for that is not so much an expression of optimism as it is kind of a cynical approach to saying, well, I know we couldn't get there to that, but I'm going to impose that because, you know, it in some ways it preserves the status quo. It preserves the idea of the inequality that we have.
Right, right. You know, I think for me, I keep, you know, what does it mean to be committed to the rule of law without exception? Mm-hmm. What might it mean to be committed to every child deserves, right, an education without exception? That everyone should have a roof over their head without exception. And when I keep saying without exception, because there's certain elements of the social contract in the United States that historically has come with exceptions.
Yeah.
That all of this applies, but not to Black folk.
But not to you. That's right.
All of this applies, but not to Native peoples. Not to folk who aren't considered one of us. Right. And this is where the rule of law runs into, you know, America as a nation of laws, run into the notion of America as, right, being defined by blood, race, right, in some ways. And so I think instead of talking about colorblindness, right, I'm more interested in application of principles without exception.
Mm. Yeah.
A society that is just without exception. And once we get there, then we could bring the fullness of who we are. I'm not giving up. I love being Black. I am rich like the King of Kings because I was born in this tradition.
Right. I'm not walking away from that.
Nah,
right?
I don't want to give that up. I love being Black, but I don't want that to come with a set of, you know, assumptions about my capacities and my potential, a set of barriers and burdens because the society is organized in such a way that certain people are valued more and others are devalued because of the color of their skin.
Yeah.
And that's a different kind of orientation than some notion of color blindness that's extracted from human doing and suffering.
I mean, I love that. I love that phrasing, right? Without exception. Can we create a set of standards that is applied without exception? And I'll be honest, I feel like at least on its face, that would appeal to most white Americans, right? I mean, or it should, that it's analogous in some ways. It walks hand in hand with the idea of colorblindness without, imposing this impossible to achieve, again, utopian standard, this idea that, look, all of these things that we believe we're going to apply equally to everyone.
Yeah, but then history haunts.
Right. We can't escape it.
Yeah, because we've built a society where we haven't done that.
Yeah.
And unless, you know.
And do you think most Americans don't want to do it that way?
Most Americans will say that they're committed to it, but they don't want to give up what they have in order to build a more just society. There's a zero sum game.
And when you say give up, I mean, what are you talking about? What would they have to give up?
So let's
advantage,
just,
right?
Let's just locate it squarely within my area. So higher education. So, you know, we have a system in American higher education that's hierarchical. You know, you have all of these folks who want to get their kids into Ivy League schools. And so they're spending all of this money to open up these spaces, you know, and we want to question that at some point, right? Don't fall for the okey-doke and think that only a great education is at Princeton or Harvard or Yale, but that's a different argument. But so there are all of these spaces, and those spaces were, they used to be only for a particular population. And as those institutions have tried to build, classes that reflect the full diversity of American society, of American life, there aren't as many seats available for them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And all hell has broken loose. So DEI, on a certain level, the kind of worry about DEI is about, you know, I can't get my kid that I've spent, $60,000 a year at Lawrenceville Prep or Exeter into Yale.
Right.
Because they're allowing these black and brown and women and LGBT folk in, you know, all of these folk in. And so it's a zero-sum game. I have to lose something if we're going to be more equitable in our society, which presumes that, you know, the inequities before were more just.
Right, right.
You see, and that's just one example that we could talk about. And so not—
So,
and,
so and, but let's roll with that example a little bit.
Sure.
And is that fair? Is that fair that the person who has the expectation that their child can get into Yale or Princeton or Harvard would have to give that up in order for there to be a more equitable system? And if that's true, how would you ever convince that person to go along?
Well, I think we have to convince folk that, you know, everybody's, you know, folks are going to land, you know, if you don't go to Yale, they're going to end up at Amherst or Williams or Swarthmore or Harvard or Princeton or University of North Carolina. I mean, we have to disrupt the hierarchy. That's,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
I think fundamentally. But I think it's important to understand that there's no guarantee that, you know, because you have spent all of this money and that you will work on Wall Street, that your child should automatically have access to these institutions. And it's going to be hard to convince folk that, I'm trying to say this in a way that doesn't buy into, you know, the illusion that these Ivy League schools are the best that they mm-hmm. could possibly be.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that these schools should be committed to building classes that reflect the full diversity of American life. So my daddy couldn't go to Princeton.
Yeah, right, right.
He couldn't attend. Or it's like the NBA, you know, we couldn't play in it.
Right.
Then when the field was leveled, we were able to play. You know, so I'm just saying, like, you know, it's going to have an impact. And so we just got to be committed to the ideal and fight for it, understanding that people are going to be unsettled by it. But they're going to land on their feet. They always do.
That was Princeton professor Eddie Glaude. Coming up, a look at what the Constitution says about immigration. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. In 2021, WDET hosted a book club that was focused on the Constitution. I want to bring back a part of that book club conversation because I think it sets a foundation for a topic that we're going to talk a lot about on this show in the future, immigration. Christina Rodriguez is a professor at Yale University Law School and author of The President and Immigration Law. And Ilya Soman is a professor at the George Mason University School of Law. He's also author of Free to Move, Foot Voting, Migration, and Political Freedom. Here's our conversation from 2021. Christina Rodriguez, welcome to Detroit Today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yes. And also with us is Ilya Soman.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So I'm going to start here. I would love to have both of you address how the U.S. Constitution addresses immigration and how its framing of this issue has kind of cast forward as we've gotten into the life of this country and the various controversies that have arisen over time. Professor Rodriguez, I am going to start with you.
The Constitution itself says very little about immigration. It does give Congress the power to adopt a uniform rule of naturalization, which is the path to citizenship. So those who wrote it clearly contemplated that there would be immigration, but that is the only place where you see that expressly identified. Today, the thought is that Congress's power to regulate immigration could come from any number of parts of the Constitution, the power to regulate international foreign commerce, the power to regulate interstate commerce. The Supreme Court has also found it to be a power that is effectively inherent in the idea of a nation. A nation has to be able to control its borders to remain sovereign. And so in that sense, the power of Congress to regulate is relatively uncontroversial. Today, most of the constitutional controversy has moved to the extent to which the Constitution might limit what Congress and the executive or the states, for that matter, do in their efforts to regulate immigration and the lives of immigrants. And that's where the Fifth Amendment Due Process Clause and the 14th Amendment protections for due process and equal protection come into play. And a lot of the ferment revolves around how to interpret those provisions.
Hmm. Professor Soman, I wonder what your take is on the Constitution and immigration.
Yeah, I largely agree with what Christina just said, but I would add that it's notable that nowhere in the Constitution is there listed any general power of the federal government to restrict immigration, even though the Constitution enumerates all sorts of other less significant powers. So many of the founding fathers, including James Madison and Thomas Jefferson, actually argued that the federal government did not have any general power to restrict immigration. And this was actually the dominant view held by people in the first several decades, at least after the establishment of the Constitution. And it was only in 1889, in the Chinese exclusion cases, that the Supreme Court ruled that there was actually a power to restrict immigration. And that shift in thinking was in large part the result of a rise in bigotry against Chinese and other Asian immigrants, thus leading to the Chinese Exclusion Acts, which the court upheld. So it's true today we take for granted that Congress has the power to restrict immigration and that the president has a lot of power in this area too, but it's not at all clear that this is actually true, at least according to the original meaning of the Constitution and the shift in opinion which led people to take for granted that it's true had a great deal to do with racism in the late 19th century.
So I want to go back just a bit to the founding itself and the conversations that the founders were having about the new nation they were building and the Constitution that they were designing to govern that nation. How much of what they were discussing was about who could be an American and who couldn't be an American, which is really, I think, the fundamental question when you're talking about immigration. And I think going back to that point and talking about what they thought about those things helps us understand the history of immigration in the country and the ways in which inequality, the same inequality that frames so much of the rest of the Constitution and the forming of the nation, has really influenced that idea of who gets to be an American, why, and who doesn't. Professor Rodriguez, talk about what many of the founders believed about the idea of who should be able to be a newcomer to the new nation.
So there are a number of different ways of looking at that question. The one of the earliest constitutional controversies was over the Alien and Sedition Acts that were designed to enable the Federalists to crack down on their political opponents, but also contained a law that authorized the president to expel any immigrant he deemed a threat to public safety or to the nation. It was an enormously controversial law. Both James Madison and Thomas Jefferson and many others thought that it was a violation of the separation of powers, that there was no such power to delegate to the president. It was motivated by a concern that French immigrants in particular were threats to the political power of the Federalist Party. They sympathized with Thomas Jefferson, and so immigration from the very beginning was used as a political tool to try to prevent people who were thought not to be fully loyal to the United States from remaining in the country. There were also restrictions placed on naturalization. The length of time it took to naturalize during that period was extended to 12 years, which was a way of trying to prevent immigrants from becoming voters, particularly those who were thought to be threats. The other way of looking at this question from the early period of American history is that a lot of the regulation of migration occurred indirectly through decisions that the states made about who they wanted to attract to their territories and who they essentially wanted to kick out. So there was a lot of variation in the kinds of immigrants that different parts of the country thought were desirable or not desirable. So in what is now the Midwest, in the antebellum period, the period before the Civil War, there were state laws that sought to attract immigrants, that land grants and guarantees of even voting and efforts to make it attractive so that immigrants were mostly coming from Europe at the time would come to the Midwest to settle it. Those were predominantly German immigrants. But on the Eastern Seaboard, which at this period was relatively developed compared to the West, there was a lot of resentment and hostility towards the migrants who were coming in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, primarily to the Irish, who were perceived as poor, who were poor and were perceived as brains on the public interest in the public fisc. And so there were states, including New York and Massachusetts, that tried to adopt their own deportation laws as a way of keeping the Irish in particular out because they were seen to be either unassimilable or drains on the system. And so the early history and practice of whether immigrants were welcomed or not was quite varied and had a lot to do with the development needs of the different parts of the country.
Professor Soman, are we wrong to ascribe to, I guess, the early America, even the idea of equality when it comes to something like immigration, the same way we might be wrong to ascribe too much to early America in terms of equality in other realms. In other words, does immigration, I guess, fall prey to the same kinds of shortcomings when we think of equality that other provisions of the Constitution did?
So I think in this area, as in a number of others, the founding fathers outlined very strong and idealistic principles of equality that weren't always lived up to. So George Washington, for instance, said that the United States should be an asylum for the poor and oppressed of all nations and religions. Thomas Jefferson, Madison, James Wilson, and other founders said similar things. And obviously those principles weren't always adhered to. There was the Alien Act of 1798, which Christina mentioned, though it's worth noting that Madison and Jefferson, many others, resisted it, argued that it was unconstitutional, and eventually it was allowed to expire without a single person ever actually being deported under it. And obviously, as Christina also mentioned, there were some exclusionary rules adopted by state governments. Indeed, for the first 100 years of American history, most immigration restrictions were almost entirely by the states rather than by the federal government. There certainly also, of course, was various kinds of bigotry against immigrants, Irish immigrants, German immigrants, later, of course, even more so Chinese and other Asian immigrants. At the same time, however, it's also remarkable that until the 1870s and 1880s, there were very few federal government barriers to immigration. And although there were some set up by the states, those who were not welcome in some states had the option of going to others. So in that respect, there was tremendous equality and opportunity. And in some ways, the performance of the early republic in this area was actually better than ours today. They didn't have horrible immigration, detention, and deportation systems like we did today. They didn't turn away refugees fleeing horrendous oppression. They didn't have many of the other practices we have today. So I think there's a lot of areas where there has been moral progress in the United States since the founding era, the area of slavery, racial equality, gender equality, and so on. In the area of openness to immigration, we are actually today worse than they were.
That was a conversation I had in 2021 with Christina Rodriguez and Ilya Soman about immigration and what the Constitution says about it. Carrie, that's a great way to end the week and a great way to end this roundup show of the week.
Absolutely. Dare I ask you again your highlight? I gave one last week. Are you going to give a
highlight of the week?
Of the week. What's your quote of the week?
I don't know that I have a quote of the week, but I certainly have kind of a moment of the week when we were talking with Eddie Glaude about the history of the Civil War and how important it is. And I was talking to him about how kind of gloomy things were and that we have these enormous challenges getting people just to focus on race and racial reconciliation. And, you know, he had this incredibly optimistic way to reframe the argument. He talked about it seeming like so many people to be a zero-sum game, but that he said it didn't have to be, and that if you thought of it in the way that that would have everybody winning, it might be easier to get more people to subscribe to it. And I just thought it was a brilliant way to phrase it.
Nice. Yeah, I agree. It's definitely – for me, when having conversations like this, it's very hard to feel like we're making progress when we're always constantly – having these very uncomfortable conversations about people who have deep-rooted feelings about certain things. Mm-hmm. And it's like, how do you move the needle on that, right? How do we get to a place where we're all on the same page about what needs to be taught, what the facts are of our history, and what those facts mean for our present society? So it's really nice for him to color it and gift it like that.
I thought it was a really great moment. And it gets to a fundamental idea of this show, right? That it's not just about inequality, but opportunity and opportunity to move forward. So a great way to end the week.
Absolutely. Well, another one in the books.
Yeah. We'll be back on Monday with really great programming. We're going to talk with Debbie Dingell, Congresswoman from Metro Detroit, and Jamal Simmons, who used to be the communications director for Vice President Kamala Harris. They are both insiders in the Democratic Party who helped bring about the change that moved our Democratic primary up, both primaries, in fact, to happen next week instead of deep into March. Mm-hmm. Michigan will matter a lot more this year in presidential politics. We'll talk about what that means from an equality standpoint. Created Equal is produced by Kerry Jr. II and David Lines. Additional production support comes from Jack Philbrant. Audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Our program director is Adam Fox. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.